This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and today's episode is Ty's report back from Destination Star Trek in Birmingham. He'll be bringing you some interviews with Star Trek alumni from Deep Space Nine, an astronaut, and two people from the European Space Agency, Rosetta project scientist Matt Taylor, who joined us on that episode featuring Tim Peake from Space Rocks, and Nicole Kaplan. But before to get onto that, there's been an update about TronFest. If you've been keeping an eye on our social media, you'll notice that we had to actually postpone TronFest, and it's actually quite good news because we've now switched it to the planetarium. So in December 10th, 2019, Classic Tron in the planetarium. We're not doing the double bill anymore, but we've still got Dr. Pete Etchells talking about the science of computer games just for about 20 minutes or so before we get underway with watching Tron in the planetarium here in Bristol. You can get your tickets at tronfest.co.uk. But it was a bit of a momentous day for the Cosmic Shed yesterday. Steve and I were in London. We went to Comic-Con and met Paul Franklin, who won the Oscar for his effects on Interstellar, of course the first film we ever covered here on The Cosmic Shed, and we'll bring you that interview in another episode coming soon. We also went to the War of the Worlds immersive experience. If you get the chance to go to that, do so. It is wonderful. And in something of a sci-fi trilogy, we ended the day going to see Blade Runner live at the Albert Hall, which was, as you can probably imagine, all kinds of wonderful too. But while we were there, Ty was at Destination Star Trek.
Hey, Cosmic Shed listeners, this is Ty. I've just left Destination Star Trek after having a lovely afternoon hanging out with some of the friendliest Star Trek fans you could ever hope to meet. In the interviews I managed to get done today, you will hear me talking to various representatives of the European Space Agency, ESA, or the ESA, as only I call it, because ESA just sounds weird to me. So you'll hear interviews, hopefully, with the lead scientist for the Rosetta Project. Let's see, Frank de Wijn, who was the first European commander of the International Space Station. I also got to sit down with Deep Space Nine cast members Chase Masterson, who plays Lisa, and J.G. Hertzler, who played General Martog. They were good fun. And also a conversation I had with the Trekkie girls, where if you like Star Trek and you're on social media, you'll be aware of their webcasts and frequent updates and their perspectives on all things Star Trek. So it was great to walk around the exhibition, just see all the props and the exhibits they've got. They had a Captain Picard Museum promoting Star Trek Picard, which was great. I took some pictures of the as-un-yet-seen Admiral uniform that Admiral Picard wears. Check out the Cosmic Shed's Twitter feed for that. And basically, it was just a good fun. I might have spent too much money on stuff, so let's keep that under the radar so my wife doesn't find out, and hopefully you'll all enjoy these interviews.
4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition and liftoff. Liftoff of the Soyuz rocket transporting Roman Romanenko, Frank de Wijn, and Bob Thirst to double the population of the International Space Station.
I flew the first short duration mission in 2002, which was basically an exchange of the Soyuz mission. It was called the Odysseya mission. And then afterwards, in 2009, I flew a long-duration space mission to the International Space Station when our Columbus module was already up there. And in the second half of that mission, I had the privilege to become the first European commander of the ISS. I've always been a very big fan of Star Trek. It's one of the reasons that I was attracted to space, actually. More particularly, I'm a very big fan of Star Trek The Next Generation, which, by the way, has been also the example for my poster of my mission, Expedition 21 on the International Space Station.
That's amazing. And how long were you in space for in total?
Just under 200 days, 199 days, actually, to be exact.
That's incredible. And did you always have an interest in science?
I had an interest in science and technology from when I was young. It's also what I wanted to study, become an engineer, mathematics. But also, yes, Star Trek certainly played a big role in that, the fascination of space. And also when I was in the high school, it was the time of the big discoveries, supernovas, black holes, a lot of popular science around that. And that combined, of course, with Star Trek really made me dream a lot about space.
Could you talk to us about what the ESA is working on at the moment?
ESA, as always, is working on new science missions. We have a couple of missions that are flying for the moment, Beppo Colombo, for example. In exploration, we are going to launch our ExoMars mission next year. First mission that's going to drill under the surface of Mars. Really exciting. But we are, of course, also working on the future of human spaceflight. We are working with our NASA colleagues to participate in the Gateway and to start sustainable exploration of the lunar surface. And we hope that in the next decade, the first European astronauts can fly not only to the ISS, but can fly to the moon.
Science and science fiction has always had a very symbiotic relationship, where sometimes science fiction influences scientists and also vice versa, sci-fi shows try and embrace the latest science. Is there anything that you and your colleagues have been inspired by in Star Trek when planning these missions?
When planning these missions, I think it's a little bit more difficult. I cannot see this directly. But of course, there are a lot of things when you look to Star Trek that somehow we are trying to mimic. Think, for example, recycling. Yeah? If we will go to further destinations, the moon, Mars, in a sustainable way, we will have to recycle all our food. Okay, it will not be a replicator like we see on Star Trek. I think we are too far away from that. But nevertheless, it will be the same principle. We will break down the human waste, all the waste that we produce, into molecules, and we will build them up again in different molecules that we can use again to drink and to eat. So certainly, yes, the principles that we find in a lot of these science fiction movies, and especially in Star Trek, is things that we are working on.
Fantastic. And just looking around us, you've got posters here of like some of the ESA's kind of greatest hits, if you will, from the Solar Orbiter to the Rosetta probe that landed on the asteroid. The legacy of the ESA is incredible. What do you think is going to be the big achievements for the agency going forward?
Well, I think the big achievements that we will see is in the exploration domain, for sure, the ExoMars mission. And then we are also working together with our NASA colleagues on a Mars sample return mission. So imagine that for the first time, we can bring a sample back from Mars to Earth, and it can be examined here on Earth and with all the technology, all the labs that we have here on Earth. It will be amazing. And certainly as well, as an astronaut, I would hope that in the next decade I can see one of the young astronauts that are currently in the European Astronaut Corps fly to the moon.
And your spacefaring days now over? Are there any plans for you to go back up there?
Well, I'm the head of the European Astronaut Corps at this stage, so it's up to the young guys to fly. Unfortunately, I should say, or fortunately, it's now the next generation, of course, that is at the helm. But there are two great jobs in the agency. The best job is being an astronaut, and the second best job is being the boss of the astronauts. And I've been able to be both of them, so I cannot complain.
Well, you're much younger than John Glenn was when he went up in the shuttle again, so I think there's still hope for you. In terms of this weekend, are you looking forward to anything? Are you planning on meeting any of the guests that are here? Are you just going to be manning the stall? Are you going to be able to partake in any of the things that are going on around you?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here, to be in the environment of all these space enthusiasts. And certainly I'm going to try to share my experience and the future plans of ESA here on stage in a short while. And share this with all the participants here in the audience. And that for me is really the highlight. It's part of our job. We have been very privileged that we could fly to space, and it's now our job as well to share this experience with all the people around.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, this podcast is obviously an audio medium, so people won't be able to see some of the incredible models of the ESA projects you've got here, including the Rosetta probe. So we're here with Matt Taylor, project scientist for the Rosetta project. Matt, What are you doing here at Destination Star Trek?
Oh, it's a good question. It's been an ongoing activity from some of us within the European Space Agency to take advantage of the natural interlink between science fiction fans and what we do in reality in space. So we're here to talk about what the missions that we fly, the activities that we do, and it's a really good environment to do that because it's an interested public that are here at the Star Trek convention.
And you've actually kind of got models or replicas of the probes here, and everyone has seen pictures of Rosetta. I had no idea it was so small.
No, well, that's a quarter-sized model. So
that would explain it.
So basically, the model we got here is 8-metre wingspan. The real one's 32 metres.
Ah.
So that would take up... I know we've got a big booth, but we wouldn't fit the real one in here. It's about 2x2 or by 3 metres. It's a huge spacecraft. Some of the other ones, a bit smaller, but still, all the ones we've got are 1-in-10 models. So, yeah, the Gaia's a 1-in-10, the Bepi Colombo's a 1-in-10. These are big beasts in reality, and if we had the real ones here, there wouldn't be much room for all the Star Trek fans.
We should kind of point out that in the middle of this massive hall at the NEC, the ESA is dominating the centre of it here. You guys have got a massive stand. And are these Star Trek fans interested in the real-life scientists that are doing this?
Absolutely. We've done a few of the destination conventions, and each year the organisers have said, look, you were a big hit, let's do more of this. And each year each event, we're trying to do something a little bit different. This one we've augmented our stand. Again, thanks to Destination. It's all their wish to have us here and do these talks. We're lucky this time as well that we were able to bring Frank DeVinna, who I think you've spoken to, who has a fantastic connection with Star Trek, and Patrick Stewart, because both were European commanders, as it were. And Frank was the first European commander on the ISS, so we've got this nice interlink between the two of them.
And what about your personal history with Star Trek? Were you into sci-fi as a kid? Did that kind of influence you getting into the space agency at all?
It's an interesting one. I hadn't realised it until I started doing these conventions and speaking to people on the back of Rosetta who were interested in where I came from and what my path was. I'd say probably what I would say is computer gaming was what brought me in this direction. Yeah, I used to watch Trek on the telly. I'm more, I would say, a Star Wars fan, which I have to be careful about saying that here. It's fine. But yeah, maybe tonight and tomorrow I'll be wearing one of my my Stormtrooper outfits. Well, not the outfit, but one of my jackets that I got in trouble last year. But I was demonstrating that I can do both universes.
Exactly.
But yeah, I would say, yes, it's something that inspires you and makes you have that thought of, well, what is out there? It's that natural instinct from humans to investigate these things. And yeah, as a kid, I was into, as I said, gaming, Elite, the old Spectrum game, and then science fiction. And here I am doing it in reality.
And you're the lead project scientist on Rosetta, still an ongoing project. What is the latest on with that?
I mean, we destroyed the spacecraft 3 years ago, but we're still going on with making sure all of the data that we got down is in the best quality. And we're kind of near the end of that. So within ESA, that's called we start to move into what's the legacy phase. Basically, there's no support for it anymore. So a little bit of my time is still spent looking after Rosetta, representing Rosetta. That's the reason I'm here, actually, is because of Rosetta. Because of Rosetta's peak of interest in the public when it was in full operational phase, that drove a number of conventions to invite me and some other colleagues to do these presentations. But going back to your original question, we're really digging into the data and going back to the first results that we had in 2014, 2015, and revising them and enhancing them given the increased knowledge that we have. And actually, the big thing now, I would say, what Rosetta's, hopefully part of Rosetta's legacy, is that we're now going to embark on a new cometary mission in 2028 called Comet Interceptor. So this is a probe that will wait in space for a brand new comet, a dynamically new comet that we've never seen before, to come through, and we'll put the thrusters on and fire ourselves at this comet and fly past it and try and investigate the newness of it to see where this thing came from and what it tells us about our solar system. So it's a really exciting mission, and I'm really pleased that I'm now involved in that.
So is there a particular comet you guys have got your eyes on, or is literally this probe going to be sitting in space?
It's going to sit in space waiting for a new comet. Maybe it's going to be one of these interstellar comets that we've seen a couple of in the last couple of years, but the prime aim is to do or go to a comet that's never really been around the sun before. So we don't know. We know what the statistical possibility of these coming in. It's reasonably high, but we just have to play a waiting game.
And obviously, a lot of these Star Trek fans, myself included, love science. Do you get any people kind of asking for jobs?
Yeah, of course. So we will tell people the process. It depends what job you want. I mean, for most of the jobs of my my science colleagues here, it requires a PhD. So you have to do postgraduate study.
Damn it.
Yeah, to be a scientist. Engineering path is a bit different, but yeah, I'd just say come to the booth and ask us, fire emails, get hold of us on Twitter. There are careers pages on ESA, so there are many different paths. Actually, I've just given you the science one, but there are plenty of different paths and plenty of different careers, and that's exemplified by the range of people we've got here. I said we've got scientific colleagues, but also we've got engineers, people supporting from the administrative side. There's a guy here who's involved in planetary protection. He's a lab manager. Actually, he's the one that makes sure parachutes and things that go to Mars aren't contaminated. So there's all these different careers that you can follow. So hopefully that comes across in the discussion over the weekend with people.
And you said Rosetta's wrapping up and then it's Comet Intercept. Are you going straight onto that or are you working on anything
else? I'm already working on it now. Oh, okay. So yeah, I've phased away from Rosetta into Comet Interceptor, and there's a few other things I'm dabbling with, but I won't go into those. One of them though actually is the Lunar Gateway. We'll have a talk later on today, actually, yeah, in about 4 o'clock, which is no good for your podcast, but by James Carpenter, who's one of our leading experts in lunar exploration and the program that we have there. So I'm working a little bit with him with the Gateway, which is a new project of a kind of, it's not the same as the International Space Station, something like that. It's more of a Winnebago that will be in orbit around the moon as a kind of logistical base for deployment onto the moon in the next decade, hopefully.
Sounds awesome. Well, good luck with that.
Thanks very much, man.
We're here with friend of the Cosmic Shed, Captain Kaplan of the European Space Agency, Antarctigrade expert. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
You've been on the Cosmic Shed podcast a couple of times now talking about tardigrade and science. What is new in the world of tardigrades?
We're not actually planning to send tardigrades back to the ISS for some time, but it is the organism that seems to get people worked up the most. And this is because of the crash-landed Israeli spacecraft, which, to quote many media sources, spilled tardigrades onto the moon, which, yes, it happened. And part of my job at ESA was to get the facts straight and to establish whether or not that actually posed a planetary protection risk.
And how's it looking?
It's looking fine to me. I would say don't panic. I was saying don't panic because the tardigrades that were sent were encased in multiple layers of epoxy resin and different metals, and they were desiccated. In order to have active samples, you need to hydrate them, and of course there's no water on the moon, so there's no risk of that.
Okay. So, I mean, you're here at Destination Star Trek. Tardigrades may or may not have played a prominent part in Star Trek Discovery. Do you find people coming up to you and just kind of probing your brain about what was real, what's not, what's possible, what isn't?
Yeah, sure. And actually, what I would say about this crash-landed spacecraft is that it's done a world of publicity for tardigrades. I mean, before, I don't think many people actually knew what they were. Maybe they knew them by the colloquial term water bears. I think if you studied biology, basic biology at school or A-level, you would have been introduced to them. But not in this way.
And when you planning to get your nerd on here at Destination Star Trek, are you planning on talking to any of the guests, or are you just here as an expert?
I'm here first and foremost as an expert, but I do see myself looking around at all of the stands. And people are in such amazing costumes as well. I can see myself really getting sucked in, and it's a pity I didn't dress up myself, but maybe by tomorrow I'll be wearing something.
I know, there are some amazing outfits around here, and I feel that we're kind of slumming it in T-shirts and polo shirts.
Well, I've got an ESA-branded polo shirt. So
all right, okay, don't rub it in.
Taxpayers' money.
Fair enough. Well, thanks so much. And I'm sure Andrew will get you back on the podcast when there's new tardigrade news to tell the world.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ty. Thanks, Nicole. Great to hear from Nicole and, of course, Matt Taylor again. And, of course, the first European Space Agency International Space Station Commander, Frank DeWin. Wonderful stuff, Ty, although you really do need to be able to say ESA. Anyway, Tai moved on from the ESA stand and met up with J.G. Hertzler and Chase Masterson from Deep Space Nine, and he began by talking to them about the What We Left Behind documentary, all about Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
The documentary did a good job of kind of like in 20 years, Nog is now a captain when they're speculating about a future season.
Oh, right, right.
But they didn't, obviously, in the first episode, manage to kind of outline where Martok and Lisa would be 20 years later. Where would you see your characters? Is Martok still Chancellor, Alita and Rom still together?
Martok's flower shop is where I would be. Probably filled with Venus flytraps and other carnivorous plants.
There you go. You know, there's two ways you could go with Lita. She's definitely still with Rom. You know, she's got Lita's secret, which is like the Ferenginar Victoria's secret. But no, I think she would choose not to do that and choose to spend her time on social justice. You know, having the people of Ferenginar be what's important and not the money, not the latinum, but social causes.
I love being part of the documentary. I noticed I was... The longest story I told in the documentary was cut, but it shows up on the bonus material. It was during Far Beyond the Stars. Mm. And I was sitting off stage. Everybody was out of makeup in that show, and I was playing Roy Rittenhouse, the illustrator. And I was sitting off stage. I'd done something on stage, and it was, you know, between scenes. And Avery and Renee were walking off stage, and they had a pretty intense scene, and Avery was directing as well as being the lead, and he did a wonderful job. Like, Avery is probably the quietest actor. Al Pacino, I did a scene with in Injustice for All. Al Pacino was very quiet when he started out. Then he became, 20 years later, it's like, whoa! You know, he's like, anyway. Avery's very, very, very quiet as an actor. He was the loudest director I've ever heard. Anyway, so we were walking off. They were walking off stage. Renee and Avery was saying, no. What I need is an incredibly intense anger. And Renee said, well, that's what I did. He said, no, it's got to be, it has to be an intensity that is red hot anger. And Renee, well, I gave you that. That's what I gave you. And he said, no, it's important that it's not red hot, but white hot. Anger that's just burning. That's, Renee says, that's what I gave you. That's what I did. And Avery goes, that's it. That's what I want. And Avery said, well, that's mine. You can't have it. I've never heard any actor ever say that.
Well, that's mine. You can't have it.
Well, that's mine. You can't have it.
That's hilarious. Oh, man.
And Renee is recognized as the greatest commedia actor, you know, farce actor in the American theater. So he's an incredibly funny man. But he was so frustrated at that moment. He said words that I've never heard any actor say anywhere, anytime. Renee has been acting for 450 years.
Yeah.
He has done everything.
Fine,
and the fact
I'm
that,
sure
yeah,
was,
I'm sure.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But Avery, you know, was a perfectionist and is a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that he, whatever was coming through the lens was different than what the actor...
Yeah,
so it ends
I
up
don't
that
know. One thing I'd love to say about the DS9 doc is, other than that, I'm really happy for Ira being able to get us all together and tell all of these incredible stories, is that, I mean, the person who really shone in that doc was Aaron Eisenberg.
Yeah.
And how beautiful it was that he had those moments to talk about Nog and how passionate he was and so touched that he was able to tell Nog's story and be such a huge part of this beautiful show. And
yeah,
we miss you, Aaron, so much, and it doesn't seem real. It feels like you're just going to come in
to the next
convention.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just tell some silly joke and we'll all be laughing again.
I also wrote two books called Left Hand of Destiny, and there's a character in it called Phar, P-H-A-R, and that character in my mind was Aaron, was Nog. You know, but I could, for some reason, I wasn't allowed to use Nog. But if you read the book, you'll see that it's Aaron Eisenberg that's there behind that character. Anyway, one of the first scenes I think we had together was a bunch of us Klingons were hanging out on the promenade, and we're out there and causing laughing as Klingons laugh and making fun of Federation people because And Aaron walked over and said, "You're going to have to break it up here. You got to break it up. No hanging. No loitering." And the Klingon is just sort of turning and look at this diminutive Federation officer, because he had his Federation officer suit on. And I bent over to him and I said, "You are either very stupid or very brave. Which is it?" And he said, "Brave." He could pull that off better than anybody else on the show. I love Aaron and everything he brought to the conventions, everything he brought to the show, everything he brought to life. It's not real for me, and probably not real for you yet, and maybe never will be, because we only see each other every maybe once a year, twice a year, and we say, "Well, I'll see him at the next convention."
Yeah.
The mind of my heart, that's where it is. I know intellectually, but...
Yeah, it doesn't seem real. And Aaron was truly a person who appreciated every bit of Star Trek that he had, every bit that existed, every hello, every autograph, just literally everything about it. He was so appreciative and so funny. I mean, when people ask for, pranks or whatever, it's Aaron with that line. It's in interviews that he's done. Look them up. No one can tell a story like him, but self-sealing stem bolts. If you Google that, and it's self-sealing stem bolts, just how they had like 89 takes, and he and Sirach were on the floor, and then, just making each other laugh. And anyway, the one thing that's important I just want to say is that we really stand by Melissa, Aaron's wife. Yeah. They had just gotten married in December, and we love her, and we're going to stand by her for...
She's part of the family.
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as she needs us. She makes these little Nog characters and...
Noggins,
yeah. Yeah, so if you see Melissa, go up and give her your love and get a noggin. And anyway, yeah.
"My father is a mechanical genius. He could have been chief engineer of a starship if he'd had the opportunity. But he went into business like a good Ferengi. The only thing is, he's not a good Ferengi. Not when it comes to acquiring profit. So now, all he has to live for is the slim chance that someday, somehow, he might be able to take over my uncle's bar. Well, I'm not going to make the same mistake. I want to do something with my life, something worthwhile."
"Like joining Starfleet?"
"I may not have an instinct for business, but I have my father's hands and my uncle's tenacity. I know I've got something to offer. I just need the chance to prove it."
"See that you get that chance."
"You're going to recommend me to Starfleet Academy?"
"I'll send the letter the first thing tomorrow morning."
The Deep Space Nine cast and a lot of Trek alumni 3 years ago all signed up to the Trek Against Trump campaign. And then, unfortunately, when he was elected, I may be, in the minority and not being a fan, Trump kind of shut down. And I was just wondering... what happened?
I am vocal almost every day, several times a day. So there's nothing shut down here. As far as it being organized, I don't know about that because I wasn't one of the organizers, but our voices are loud and clear. We need that man out. He's a criminal. He has hurt our country in a way that may never be repaired. probably won't because of the Supreme Court justices, which are now in. He's basically stolen democracy, and I will never shut up about that because it's what our country was supposedly built on, even though, you know, we have a horrible history of slavery and other things that Americans don't like to talk about. But the bottom line is that he stole the election and now he's stealing democracy, and there's no reason to be quiet about it.
We're here with the Trekkie Girls, who run one of the most engaged Star Trek social accounts online. What are you here for? Who are you looking forward to interviewing this weekend?
Anson Mount, but we can't get anywhere near him.
There's restraining orders.
Really? Yeah, no. I think with the clamour for a Captain Pike TV series, everyone is just trying to get close to him. What is it about these three-day events that you look forward to? Is it meeting the cast, meeting the fans, just letting your geek flag fly uninterrupted?
We call them unreality weekends, don't we?
Yeah, so I think it's everything. We get to see friends, we get to see like a couple times a year, get to see the cast that we love. But yeah, generally it's just three-day Trekkie party. And yes, we love it.
Just for comparison, on the way up we were talking about what our favourite hob on the oven is, and we get to not talk about things like that. We get to talk about Star Trek and the future and friendship and science and exploration, and we get to ignore boring things like what's happening in the news.
We turn off the BBC alerts for 3 days.
We don't hear it at all.
That is probably a great idea with what's going on in the news at the moment.
What news?
Bubble.
So the Cosmic Shed podcast likes to look at the science behind the science fiction. So obviously we've talked to scientists, and every time we speak to the actors, we try and find out how much of the techno-babble they're actually into.
Yeah.
Do you appreciate that side of Star Trek, the science, or are you all there for the fiction?
No, absolutely love the science.
I love the science, yeah.
They inform each other, they go hand in hand, the storyline and the science. A lot of people see Star Trek, some people can watch Star Trek and say, oh, this is Shakespeare. Some people can watch Star Trek and say, this is psychology. But some people see it and say, this is pure science. I like to see a bit more of a whole and see it for all the different facets it represents. But the science is, to me, is hope, and that is development, and that is humanity going forward. So that goes hand in hand with what Star Trek stands for.
And you can see in technology itself how many things have been mirrored from the original series. We've got the first time you see a flip phone, that is exactly like the communicators. Like, it did cross both ways. They've taken from reality and naturally science, and science is taken from them, and we love that.
What do you guys actually do for a living when you're not just watching Star Trek like the rest of us?
I've had a range of careers. My main career was in politics.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course science did come into that, believe it or not. One of the most interesting discussions I had was on whether we should put fluoride into water, which involved having to take reports from scientists and take that information and make a decision that would benefit the public. And I took a very Star Trek approach to that. Not being a scientist, you want to have that opinion and have their informed opinion and make the best decision you can. And Star Trek did influence my career choice. I mean, basically, I want the world to be like Star Trek.
So I work in a library, so I'm definitely more the sort of fiction side of it. I love books and I love idealistic views of the future. And Star Trek is one of the few that is an idealistic view of the future. Most of them are dystopian futures. And I love, yes, the comparison that the future is hope rather than despair.
Well, I mean, the trailer for season 3 of Star Trek Discovery hinted that the glory days of the Federation are now behind it. Are you looking forward to that? What are your hopes for the next season of Star Trek Discovery?
Do you know what? At first, when I thought about it, I thought, I don't want anything to spare. You know, I can turn on, my BBC News alerts to get despair about the future. However, sometimes I think you need to have those stories to have hope, because actually I can look at it and think, oh my goodness, things are in a bit of peril. Like, your way of life, the safety of a Federation is at risk. I feel a bit like that in the political situation at the moment. My sort of safe bubble is starting to fall down a bit. But actually, I'm looking forward to it being rebuilt, and that's what I'm certain is going to happen in season 3.
That's exactly the same. I think having people who are still so idealistic, with the Federation being they're going to be in the future and they're going to bring it back. We're going to see a return to the glory that it was, rather than wallow in the despair that it is. So I think it will, yeah, rise up again.
Speaking of return to glory, our Lord and Saviour, Sir Patrick Stewart, strapping the uniform back on. What are you hoping for from Star Trek Picard? What do you hope it doesn't do?
We're hoping it sort of ties up lots of things from the Next Generation. There's this whole storyline with what happened to Data, what happened to B4, what happened to Lore, the whole ethics of artificial life. That kind of relates to the Borg as well. We're hoping that will get ties up. I'd like to hear more. I mean, 20 years have passed. It's the same amount of time that's passed in reality here on Earth. And what's happened in Picard's life since then? What's happened with Romulus? What's the situation there? I imagine there's an entire class of refugee people, which could be a very interesting discussion.
I'm really hoping it's something new and fresh, that it brings something new to the Picard story, so we get maybe a bit more story, like a bit more personal with Picard, because I want it to be more of a personal journey than an action-packed sort of show. But yeah.
Cool, yeah. The refugee crisis in the 24th century could be very timely.
It could be.
They do indeed tackle that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much doing this interview. Where can people find you online if they want to find out what the Trekkie Girls are up to?
You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and YouTube at Trekkie Girls, all one word.
So you're everywhere?
Everywhere.
Right, everywhere. We're like Captain Kirk and a green girl, just everywhere, you know.
Well, have a great weekend.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to the Trekkie Girls and to Ty and to everybody else who joined us for this episode of The Cosmic Shed. Don't forget to get your tickets for Tron in the Planetarium at tronfest.co.uk. We'll be back very soon with another episode on the HBO series Chernobyl. We'll be talking to the people who made the special effects, we'll be talking to people who've done research in Chernobyl itself, and with a nuclear professor. And thank you very much for listening.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.